Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, we're going to start out with an update in the Swiss solidarity letters. We had a letter back about a month ago from someone who had a friend in Switzerland who was looking for a functional medicine doctor. That letter described his symptoms. And since then, a number of people with ties to Switzerland have weighed in on the program. This latest from Sybil in Switzerland. She writes, Robert was wondering about the treatment of parasites and his friend's consequential treatment with Cipro. I'm sorry this is late. I'm behind with listening to your podcasts. I forgive you, Sybil. A friend of mine had to go to the hospital with unexplained symptoms. They couldn't figure out at first what was causing the symptoms until they saw the CT scan that she had an infection with the fox parasite Echinococcus multiocularis. She has a veggie garden, and here in Switzerland, foxes often visit vegetable gardens. And, of course, while they're there, they may leave a little gift behind. It's extremely rare, but she may not have washed her veggies thoroughly and so got infected. The problem is, the earlier this parasite is detected, the better. If it's discovered late, the treatment is very long and often lifelong. She goes on to talk about the best way to treat the illness, and wants to go on just saying that Robert's friend should be checked for this because the parasite infection is so rare, most doctors miss it, and early detection is key, but difficult because symptoms might appear after 5 to 10 years. And continuing, Sybil adds, another possibility for neurologic problems is the infection with a virus from a tick. Tick-borne encephalitis is prevalent in Europe, and unlike Lyme disease, this tick causes a serious viral infection that attacks the central nervous system and can lead to severe long-term neurological damage or death. My husband and I just got the second of three vaccines yesterday, because this illness is absolutely no joy. And that is called the FSME vaccine, and it is for tick-borne encephalitis. It is available in Europe. That is not a prevalent thing here. We do have other tick-borne diseases that cause encephalitis. So it is a worldwide problem, but the specific subtypes do vary. And I wanted to just follow up to Sybil's contribution with a little comment about cysticercosis, which is a parasite that comes from eating infected and not very, very well-cooked pork. And I think also it can get in beef, but you can fact-check me on that. In any event, this particular parasite is neurotrophic, and it is actually can grow to this. So it's more of a worm, and it is develops a calcium deposits as the result of the immune system's attacks on it. It can be killed by the immune system, but it leaves essentially a tumor in the brain that will not keep growing, thank goodness, but can be picked up on CT scan by a classic sort of ring-like appearance of calcium. And this is the quote-unquote brain infection that our current Health and Human Services Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., had. And there was much merrymaking that I thought was in very bad taste was done about that. I don't think making fun of people's health problems or personal infirmities is even valid in a political climate, but I guess I'm an outlier on that one. But let's talk about the big story this week. I have from here at Science News the latest, or at least the latest I'm going to get, which was from yesterday at 11:45 a.m. This is the hantavirus outbreak. And when scientists read about this, their first thought is, oh, goody, a natural experiment. We're going to get to learn more about hantavirus funding. Yes, sir. Good. Because, of course, in the wake of budget cuttings in the United States, especially, and dismantling of major health research institutions, well, you know that story, this is why we study obscure stuff. The Andes species of hantavirus, which, how is that going to get to the United States? That's just a boondoggle. I can hear them saying that in Congress. Well, we do have types of hantavirus here in the United States. They're typically acquired by inhaling mouse droppings from infected mice, dust and debris in a garage or a cabin in the woods that hasn't been cleaned out for a while and has been inhabited by secondary life forms. Well, some of them excrete in their stool and their urine, and the dust is contagious and can be aspirated by humans and lead to human disease. If you get this disease, severe cases have a 50%, that's 50% mortality rate. So not fun. Fortunately, because we have this disease, we do have serology tests that do identify the Andes species of hantavirus as well. The bad part of this is that people are contagious before they're infected, they're infected, but before they're symptomatic. And the serology is only good after about 10 days after infection, because it takes that long for the antibodies to show up. But so by the time you can find the antibodies in the person's bloodstream, they're no longer very contagious because they have the antibodies in their bloodstream. So yeah, early diagnosis here is not really a thing. Blame Instagram, in my opinion. The Andes used not to be a place that people, except people who are really interested in nature or interested in archaeology, would visit. Likewise, Patagonia. In the last 10 years, there's been a veritable explosion of travel to distant and exotic but Instagrammable sites from people who probably haven't considered the impact of their travel, or perhaps don't consider the impact of much. Anyway, as of the 13th, 2 days ago, the outbreak had sickened at least 11 people on a cruise ship. Scientists are still trying to decipher what makes the Andes virus different from other hantaviruses, why it can spread between humans, and why it can be so deadly. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. The cases in the Andes generally come from people breathing dried rodent excrement. And these are from a long-tailed coleargo, whose Latin name is, I love it, Oligosomiasis longicaudatus, which longicaudatus is a very fancy way of saying long-tailed. We had an outbreak of a different hantavirus, the dust one, in Yosemite about 10 years ago. And in Chile and Argentina, researchers had previously documented the Andes hantavirus being present, and people got infected by being with other people at birthday parties or funerals, in hospitals, and on long car trips and within hospitals. Now we have a bird-watching trip near a landfill in Argentina is proposed to have led to the first two cases aboard the ship. The Argentinian government is vehemently denying that, by the way. But this spreads person to person among people who have close contact. Now, close contact in epidemiology speak means people who swap spit. So that's sexual partners, those who engage in deep kissing. But it can also be those who spend long periods of time together, particularly in bedrooms or places that have poor ventilation. As the ship and other examples do illustrate, it's not always close contacts. For instance, researchers carefully reconstructed how an Andes virus outbreak in Argentina from November 2018 through February 2019 went. It infected 34 people, killed 11. There were four waves of infection that were driven mainly by cycles with three super spreaders. This was reported in 2020 in the New England Journal of Medicine. Those three people gave the virus to 21 other people. Some spread happened through casual contact. One person, for example, went to a birthday party where he sat at the next table and said hello to the super spreader on the way to the bathroom. Now, about a dozen countries are now monitoring people who were passengers or crew members who disembarked or were evacuated along the ship's route before hantavirus was identified. Plus, people who came in contact with these people who exited, who were sat next to them on an airplane flight or some other close quarters situation. It can take up to 6 weeks for symptoms to appear. Actually, another source I looked at in The Economist said 8 weeks. So the lab tests so far have confirmed 9 infections, but there's some people who died. One in April 11, there wasn't. This was a Dutch man. There was no reason to take a sample. A hospitalized British national. Oh, this is a great story. It's like this has got to be a movie. A hospitalized British national who disembarked on the South Atlantic island of Tristan da Cunha on April 14th. The island is so remote that when that person got sick, British paratroopers, some with medical personnel jumping in tandem, had to parachute in with medical supplies and oxygen to care for the man. 18 U.S. citizens from the cruise are in quarantine at various centers in Omaha, Nebraska, and Atlanta. An additional 7 ship passengers are in quarantine at home in 5 states. That makes me a little bit nervous. These are people who were on the Hondius when the first case had died but disembarked before anyone realized the virus was aboard. And another 11 Americans were sitting near an ill cruise passenger on airline flights. They're also quarantining at home. So if you do the math, we've got close to 40 people in the United States with the potential of being a super spreader and infecting others, some of whom are in a biocontainment facility, some of whom are not. We don't know for sure why the Andes virus passes from person to person more readily than the other versions. And the DNA now, of course, we have RNA and DNA research that can rapidly sequence. And the genetic makeup of the Andes virus from the Swiss passenger on the cruise ship is very, very close to the earlier study that I talked about in Argentina. And it's a close relative. This animal, the pygmy rice rat, is common in both locations, so that sort of makes sense. One reason that Andes virus may spread among people is that it grows in the bloodstream to much higher levels in humans than other types of viruses do, and no one knows why. But people are peeing out virus. It's in the kidneys. It's in the lung. It's in the saliva. And Klingstrom and other colleagues found that the Andes virus is invulnerable to the antimicrobial compounds in human saliva that kill other hantaviruses. You can inactivate it with alcohol or soap, light. So it's not that different. It's not a super virus, but it has a important invulnerability, and that's to our own salivary antibodies and antimicrobial substances. And so you can see why saliva could be a real issue here. It's also found in blood, breast milk, and semen. This was reported in Viruses in 2023, one guy who had a severe case of the Andes virus and still had viral DNA in his semen 71 months later. And this reminds me of some of what we're finding now with people who are still showing viral DNA for COVID 2 years after their last documented case of COVID. There are a lot of other variables. One of the things that is known about this is that certain people make high levels of a protein called IL-6. This is an inflammation triggering protein, and there are genetic variants in how much you make in response to a given trigger. In the Andes, it is going to produce very, very high levels of IL-6, and these are the same individuals who got sicker with COVID. Andes, like the other antiviruses, also has the ability to keep T cells from attacking. They have a stealth weapon against T cells, like an invisibility cloak. So I do not think this is going to be another global pandemic, but I am not sure that it won't. And as I look at the global response, I see that it was rapid and effective, and the communication and the cooperation were good. All right. I've learned from my work at the residency that when you give criticism, you must always say three positive things or more to every negative thing. So I think I've got one negative thing credit there. So my negative thing is going to be, we need a better, well-organized quarantine setup that is ready to go and that is consistent across nations. This has to be something that can happen, you know, like the wall comes down and everyone is treated equitably and that they're kept safe. And that would mean building facilities and having them available so that adequate quarantining could take place. And you can quarantine people in a tent. You can take a gymnasium, basically, and quarantine people in individual tents. It's very makeshift, but if you've got something that's respiratory particles or saliva like this, that's going to be good enough. And of course, masking for the people who go from space to space. But nevertheless, with a little thought and global coordination, we could have something ready for the next global pandemic so that we could limit the spread. And this is particularly important with air travel. And so that has made us so vulnerable. And the reason that we have this Andes virus where it is because people went to the Andes, right? People went to the Andes to see the Andes because they're beautiful. And the more people who make these trips to isolated biomes, the more interesting exotic bugs are going to get a foothold in other parts of the planet. Researchers say the most reliable ways to protect brain health remain decidedly unglamorous and cheap: exercise, sleep, and social connection. However, there are so many products out there, and we spend billions of dollars each year chasing the idea of a sharper mind, taking Brain Drive, Daily Brain Boost, and a whole bunch of upgrade strategies that are going to make us smarter, more competitive, give us longevity. Is it all real or is it marketing hype? Well, it's a combination, says Gary Small, a professor emeritus of psychiatry and former director of the UCLA Longevity Center. He's now at Hackensack Meridian Health. The science is changing so fast, says Dr. Small, that it's hard for even experts to sort it out. Many of these brain products are promoting brain health. They're mostly built on how the brain changes in disease. Stress that can lead to self-damage, inflammation linked to cognitive decline, amyloid buildup tied to Alzheimer's. But keep in mind, showing an effect on these pathways in a lab involving a petri dish or in animals, even on patients with illness, doesn't translate cleanly into improvement in otherwise healthy people's memory or focus. The industry often blurs that line, marketing disease-adjacent science as everyday enhancement. And that is incorrect. I want to use the analogy of if one person has pneumonia and they are coughing, then giving them an antibiotic will probably help reduce and eventually stop their coughing. If a person, however, has asthma and they're coughing because of their asthma, giving them an antibiotic will do absolutely nothing to stop their cough, and yet it's often done. Nevertheless, Dr. Small, our emeritus professor, was asked, what supplements do you take and why and what do you avoid and why? So I thought I'd share with you this scientist who's with a lifelong interest in longevity and, of course, healthy brain longevity as well. I was happy to say that there's considerable overlap, although there are some disagreements, and I will go over those as we get to them. But number one is curcumin. A number of years ago, Small came across epidemiological studies noting lower rates of Alzheimer's disease in parts of Asia where diets are rich in turmeric, the golden yellow root long used in cooking. Around the same time, laboratory research began to suggest that curcumin, one of turmeric's active compounds, had anti-inflammatory properties and thus might reduce tau and amyloid beta, the proteins most closely associated with neurodegeneration, particularly in Alzheimer's. Intrigued, Small helped conduct a small, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial of 40 adults and reported in a peer-reviewed journal improvements in memory and attention in the group that took curcumin. It was a small study, and it was never expanded, but he found the results suggestive enough to begin taking the supplement himself. He remains uncertain, but he's comfortable with the possibility that it might offer broader anti-inflammatory benefits. A 2024 review of published studies on curcumin found, quote, statistically significant improvement in cognitive performance, while cautioning about potential gastrointestinal side effects. There have been recent concerns about whether it could cause liver damage. I want to reassure you, when you look under the rug to those concerns, that was poor quality imported and contaminated product. And we'll just jump to my final point in this, just to make my final point twice. You've got to know your manufacturer. Don't buy the cheapest stuff. Watch the dosing. And your company should have a certificate from an independent assay on random batches, and that should be renewed annually at least. If it's possible to check every batch, that would be great, but that adds a great deal of expense. So if you're buying a high-end product, you should have every reason to expect that they're checking every sack of turmeric that comes in. They're spot testing for lead, mercury, and pesticides. All right, so coenzyme Q, another one that Dr. Small recommends, CoQ10. It's a naturally occurring compound that helps cells produce energy and helps protect them from damage. Dr. Small takes it because he takes a statin for cholesterol, and all of you out there who are taking a statin, there is definite evidence that CoQ10 lowers the risk for side effects like muscle aches and fatigue, and that's because we believe that the muscle aches and fatigue are due to the fact that statins lower CoQ10 levels. So, as I like to say to my patients, if you change something, put it back the way you found it, which in the case of starting to take a statin to change your cholesterol means putting that CoQ10 back by taking a supplement. I should give you doses. For the curcumin, about 500 to 1,000 milligrams of quality curcumin. If you are taking turmeric, you're going to need 10 times more. Now, it's certainly possible to take 5 grams of turmeric on a regular basis if you really like to use it in your cooking. It's only about a tablespoon of shaved root. You would also need to add about 1/8 tablespoon of ground black pepper in order to improve the bioavailability. But that's also well within the range of what people could actually manage. We're going to go to finish off here with Dr. Small. He agrees with me on the multivitamin. We do disagree on the omega-3, but Dr. Small says, I eat enough fish, I'm getting enough omegas, and that's enough for him. I am willing to go for super omegas, and I don't worry that I'm going to be hurting myself by having more, because, again, staying within physiological boundaries, the amount of omega-3s that are in your body can be tested. The ratio of the omega-3s to the omega-6, called the omega-3 index, can be tested. Even Quest runs these tests. And you want a good omega-3 ratio or a good omega-3 index. There are two different tests. They're designed a little bit differently. But the healthy range there, you want to be in that healthy range. And on the, you know, the positive side of that healthy range, as far as you can get, and this is one of the ways that you come closest to what we are biologically adapted for. Now, we're not biologically adapted to eat fish. We're biologically adapted to eat a whole lot of plants than we're currently eating. And we don't do that. And so as a result, our omega, and we are not biologically adapted to eat grain, but our diets are very high in grain relative to the let's call it the evolutionary diet. And so that pushes up the omega-6. And then we came along and discovered industrial hydraulic presses and started squeezing seeds and getting oil out of them. And so anything that, you know, is expeller pressed oil is subject to an industrial process that never existed. I mean, cavemen and the Greeks could crush olives and make olive oil. That is an oil that does not require industrial steam or other power to squeeze the oil out under high pressure. But that high pressure oil definitely is much more of an omega-6 in its flipping the ratios. And then as we began feeding our meat animals grain to fatten them up, we ended up turning animals that historically were high in omega-3 to animals that were high in omega-6. And now, if you want high omega-3 eggs, you can buy them because the market has said that omega-3 is good. And so the people have gone back to feeding the chickens plants rather than feeding the chickens grain. Well, grain is technically a plant, but green plants, things that not the seeds of the green plants, are where you find your omega-3s in nature. Things that he recommends against that I agree probably you don't need, creatine. Some people, I do not think that there is enough evidence to link it to better working memory and processing speed. I'd want to see more replication of that. I think it's something right now that's having its internet moment. There may be some benefits, there may be some side effects, but I'm not taking it, and I do take an awful lot of things. Ditto for phosphatidylserine. This is supports cognitive health because it's part of the brain cell membranes. It does improve memory function. There's one study in Japan that showed that about 10 years ago. It can be found naturally in fish, soybeans, and eggs. So my calculus there is I'm getting enough of it from my diet, which is high in all three of those, that I don't need it. And then the latest internet star is nicotinamide riboside, which is a form of vitamin B. And this is one where I really want to emphasize that this is bells and whistles and window dressing, and there isn't enough data to show that this does any of the things that it purports to do. So I'm throwing a thumbs down on that one for the moment, and just reminding you that you need to be selective and a little bit critical, and not believe if the person on the website is selling something or linking to a site that sells something, then you have to take anything that site says with a grain of salt. And the whole business of being an influencer is based on being a bot witness for fill in the blank, for product X. You are putting yourself out there as witness for sale that your product is wonderful. And then you are witnessing. And if you have a lot of followers, then they love you because you're such a good influencer. Then they're likely to believe that your witnessing is actually a legitimate opinion. And it's not. Just keep that in mind. We'll see if we can pick up this call. Hello, this is Dr. Motika.
Hi.
Hi. Can you give me your name and where you're calling from?
Sure. Name is Lawrence, and I'm calling you from Georgia.
Well, hello, Lawrence from Georgia. And what can I do for you tonight?
Sure. I have got two questions. One, I'm 77 years young. I want to ask you about the pros and cons of taking supplements. And if supplements are good, healthy, forceful like myself, which ones would you recommend? Secondly, what do you think of the idea of men my age taking testosterone injections? And also, are there any side effects?
All right. Let me start with the testosterone injections.
Okay.
And I can speak from a position of authority because I use a lot of testosterone in older men, and I have, and I'm including patients up into their 80s. I use it in situations where I'm trying to support muscle mass because as we age, we lose muscle mass. As we lose muscle mass, we become insulin resistant, and then that goes into diabetes. So I'm very big on maintaining your muscle. I check my muscles, my patients' muscles by looking at their fatty mass to lean body mass every year because their skeleton and their blood doesn't change, but their muscles do. And by doing that research, I can tell you, if you're laid up in the hospital for 2 weeks and not getting much exercise, maybe you have a procedure, there's a few days you don't eat before the procedure and maybe a couple days after where you're not very hungry, you've lost a substantial amount of muscle and you need to grow it back pronto. And so that's the sort of situation where having that piece of paper from their previous physical, I could point to and say, you've lost 10% of your muscle mass. Now you have to, now you need to do something about that. Here's a plan. Let's make a plan. And that little bit of information is very persuasive and really gets people's attention. But I hope that my words can get your attention to say maintaining your muscle mass as you age is the most important thing. So when we are talking about aging, getting to the testosterone briefly, I don't like injections. And you get more side effects with injections because they make your testicles shrink, because that's one, because they raise a protein in your blood called sex hormone binding globulin. And what that does is it's a protein in your blood that grabs onto testosterone and deactivates it as long as it's holding on to it. And so it can't get to the receptors. And the problem is your blood test, if they check you for testosterone, your blood levels are 600. But if your SHBG is 100, then most of that 600 is just sitting there in the arms of a protein circulating around your bloodstream, not getting to any of the testosterone receptors. So if you use the testosterone as a patch or a cream or a gel, you take it the way your body intended to take it, or your body is designed to give a blast of testosterone every morning. Hence the physiological effects of having a full bladder and getting an erection. You've got a higher testosterone level in the morning. And I guess nature figures this is your last chance to reproduce, dude, before you go out and get eaten. So go for it. I am thinking that there's probably some adaptive value to it that is evolutionary, but it's there. And we want to mimic our natural physiology and our natural body clock as much as possible. The injected testosterone is kind of old-fashioned. It comes from the bodybuilders. You remember the East German swim team in the 70s, and those women came out from East Germany, and they were like so hypertrophied in their upper body, and everybody looked at them and said, what? That's not what women look like. Well, it is when you give them testosterone shots. And as I remember, and so that was when all the doping and all that other stuff happened with the Olympics. Somebody had to do it before they decided to make it illegal. And so it's unnatural to do it that way. I'm just biased towards staying within the boundaries that our normal physiology has. But I do think that getting, for example, if a man's in his 70s, getting his getting his testosterone up into the 300, 400 range is going to help him. I have personally treated people with prediabetes who've been exercising, and it isn't helping, and we find their testosterone is like 150, 200. Put them on the testosterone, and you check it twice or three times before you commit to that, because it goes up and down. And you check it in the morning, because that's when it's highest. But then if you've got a consistently low level, you treat to, like I said, you know, 300 to 400 range. And I've had at least two cases where they completely remitted their prediabetes and got back down to a hemoglobin A1C of 2.6. And of course, they were doing other stuff, but they'd been doing the other stuff for a while, and we weren't moving the needle. So that's when we added in the testosterone. And I'm not trying to make anybody, you know, buff. I'm just trying to keep them from losing their muscle mass. I think it's a really good thing.
I mean, this is wonderful. What can I say? First, you are the best. You're the best. A couple of fast questions. You mentioned the cream, the gel, the patch. Are those products available over the counter, or do I need a prescription for them, number one?
It's a controlled substance. It's actually, okay, it's at the same level of control as a hydrocodone.
Okay, so I need my doctor. Okay. Number two, maintaining my muscle mass, you know, I'm kind of into weight training, mm-hmm, lifting weights. Is that something that you would highly recommend,
yes,
for someone of my age?
Well, assuming that your heart is healthy, and it sounds like you're already doing it, so you're adapted to it. You want to watch your blood pressure, because weightlifting, definitely when you're straining, even if you're exhaling and doing all the proper techniques, it's going to raise your blood pressure for those moments. So we don't want your blood pressure starting out at 160 over 90 and blowing up to 210 over, you know, 100. We want your blood pressure starting out at 35 over 75 and blowing up to 60 over 90. You know what I mean? So that's one thing. And all the advice I give is contingent upon you having been checked out by a doctor and having been cleared for the usual suspects, heart disease, hypertension, you know, et cetera. But it's really a good idea. Getting back to your question about nutrients and supplements, the other thing I do is I push protein and fluids. You don't want to just, so it's like protein, you take your weight and in pounds, and you divide by 2.2, and that's 2.2. And that's the number of grams of protein you should be eating. Sorry, not your weight, your age. You take your age. You take your age, and you don't divide by 2.2. I'm sorry, I talked about heart rate last week, and it just crept back into my discussion here.
Okay.
So, no, let me. You take your age, and your age is the amount of grams. Your age is the amount of grams of protein you need. So that's a minimum. And when you exercise, when you're muscle building, you have to have at least 5 grams of what we call branched-chain amino acids in your system. And so you can buy supplements that have branched-chain amino acids in them. You can add them. You can add 5 grams worth to your water bottle and drink that while you exercise. And that will stimulate the development of muscle. And the older you get, you need to be fed when you exercise. Do not expect results for bodybuilding if you're over 65. If you're fasting, it won't work. Your body will.
Oh.
So you've got to have eaten, and ideally you've eaten a protein meal, and you can just do for the branched chain amino acids, just do a dash of something in your water. It's just easy and convenient and not very expensive, but it really, really works. Now, in terms of anti-inflammatories, we've talked about curcumin. I recommend a multivitamin for everybody. The American diet, particularly if you're eating food that it might be healthy food, but it's been processed. I'll see these, they're basically like a fried snack food, and it's made of peas or it's made of garbanzo beans. But, you know, that stuff has been chopped up, boiled, chopped up, extruded, and then air fried. And most of the healthy molecules that were in that food have been bent and twisted and destroyed as far as being any kind of chemical signal. Because the healthy parts of vegetables are complicated molecules. They're not just like a mineral like calcium. I mean, calcium is, you know, it's basically rock. And you can you can chop and pound and do anything you want to rock, and it's still rock. But when you're talking about something that's a complex molecule, like glucosinolide. Okay, that's the thing in broccoli is glucosinolide. That's a complicated molecule, and if you overprocess it, you destroy it. So it's nice to take the vitamins. That's what's in a multivitamin, and it usually has the minerals. It doesn't usually have calcium. If a person's eating dairy and they're probably getting enough calcium. If you're not eating dairy and you're eating meat, you're probably getting enough calcium because muscle is full of calcium. If you're a person who eats a lot of bread and vegetables, I call them vegetarians, you may not be getting enough calcium. Or if you're an older person and don't make a lot of stomach acid, you may not be getting enough calcium. So calcium is complicated, and there's no one-size-fits-all. I try to make...
I'm sorry. Last question.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. What's your opinion about taking fish oil supplements? Good or bad?
Now, that was actually on the thing here. Fish oil supplements need to be high quality, so they need to be tested for mercury. Because they can, if they're made out of fish, a lot of the bigger fish, you know, would have a lot of accumulated mercury in particular. So you got to watch for that. A reputable company, I really like them for the anti-inflammatory effect, and they contain substances, EPA and DHA, which are types of omega-3s that have been shown to be very helpful for heart disease and general inflammation. There's some data on DHA and brain health in infants, which is really interesting. It may actually raise, the mother is taking fish oil, it may actually raise the baby's IQ. That's controversial, because that's quite a variable thing, and you can't test the IQ until the kid's much older, so a lot of potential confounds are there. But there's a trend there. So I think I take fish oil every day. I take about 1,000 milligrams of a company called Nordic Naturals, and I put it in my shake, so I don't have to taste it. It's been bubbled through with hydrogen, and the hydrogen bubbles take away the fishy taste. And so I put it in my fruit and vegetable and protein powder shake, and that's my breakfast with multivitamin ground up in it. Because if I took all of the stuff as capsules, I'd be taking 20 capsules. So instead, anything I can throw into the blender goes into the blender, and these things play happily together. They are found together in a meal, and they get in there just fine. So I figure a shake is a meal, and call it good.
Thank you, Dawn. Thank you so much.
You're
thank
welcome.
You so much.
And my just thank you so much for reaching out. Especially, it's what is it now? It's like 11 o'clock or 10:30 over where you are.
No, you guys are 3 hours earlier than I am.
Oh, 3 hours earlier?
Yeah.
Yep, that's right. So you're later at night, is what I'm saying.
That's correct.
Yeah, Well, anyway, thank you for staying up late to call Dr. Dawn.
Oh, it was my joy. Bye-bye. Oh. Take care.
Bye-bye. Let's go to another email. This one comes from Lloyd in Santa Cruz. Ask Dr. Dawn, renaming PCOS to PMOS. PCOS, not just for girls anymore. Actually, it never was. It's being renamed to polyendocrine metabolic ovarian symptom. And the article that Lloyd sent to me was interesting. It came out of the Lancet Health Policy. So it's not really a scientific article, but it does have some interesting points that are scientific. Essentially, polycystic ovary syndrome, also previously called Stein-Leventhal syndrome, which was even more opaque, affects 1 in 8 women. But the term is very inaccurate because it implies pathological ovarian cysts, and it emphasizes them, obscuring the fact that this is actually an endocrine and metabolic disease. And because of the absence of cysts, many doctors mistakenly for decades and decades have looked at people with hirsutism and masculinization, females with masculinization, people who had obesity, people who had a sort of framework of metabolic syndrome and mustache hair on females, and acne, which are both androgen type side effects, were, well, you don't have cysts, you can't have polycystic ovary disease. So we need to change that. And furthermore, it's now that awareness is changing, we're realizing that, no, this is not just for girls. There are plenty of genetic males who, regardless of where they identify, they are genetically male, which means they are genetically male, which means that they are genetically male, and they will get this too. So it is not, it is a polyendocrine disease. It creates metabolic syndrome, which is where you have too much insulin, and that too much, and you also have polyendocrine disorder because you have too much testosterone and too much DHEA. And the ovarian, if you have ovaries, they're out of whack too and not doing what they're supposed to do. It is essentially the chemical symphony of the endocrine system is dissonant, discordant, and out of step with itself. And because of that, rebranding was definitely overdue. There are plenty of people with this syndrome who don't have cysts, and there are plenty of people with the syndrome who don't have ovaries. Another test that I'm going to throw out there is elevated anti-Mullerian hormone, which is a blood test and should probably be done along with tests for testosterone and DHEA. When you're seeking to identify this, we also want to look at hemoglobin A1C and maybe do a glucose tolerance test, hypertension, elevated cholesterol, and fatty liver disease are also associated with the metabolic syndrome we're discussing, and also sleep apnea and obesity, and of course, infertility and reproductive problems, and endometrial cancer, and psychological disorders, and eating disorders, and acne, hair loss, and extra hair in the wrong places. So lose your hair on your scalp, grow it elsewhere. Thin people can have this polyendocrine metabolic ovarian syndrome. All the way back in 2012, the U.S. National Institute of Health of Disease Prevention said we should change the name. They recommended a change in 2012. And there have been multiple efforts over the years to try to get that changed. But the previous efforts never got traction. Barriers including lack of inclusive global leadership and a need for a coordinated consensus process and alignments and agreements on the name and a comprehensive strategy to implement the change. So after multiple mistrials, this is now a story of how they actually did it. It's about 10 more pages that I shall simply extract to say there was an amazing cost and complexity of changing a disease name, and the massive numbers of stakeholders involved that had to be coordinated, and the pure expense of such an undertaking is actually mind-boggling. Given the sunk cost and the advantages of the name change and the concomitant education of the public and providers, I hope it succeeds. But it is pushing a big rock up a steep hill to change the name of the disease, and I think this one was worth it. So thank you, Lloyd, for bringing that story to my attention. There's a lot of inertia in the system, folks, and sometimes it works in our favor and sometimes it works against us. This is kind of a cool news of the weird. Why old houses are spooky. You know, when old buildings and you kind of go into a haunted house, I mean, I went into haunted houses as a kid, not the carnival kind, but like real deserted houses with furniture and shredded curtains. And it was always a very cool and spooky feeling, partly because of the lure of the forbidden. A new study suggests that infrasound, which is low-frequency sound waves below the range of human hearing, can alter people's moods and raise their stress hormones, even when they don't know they're hearing it. Researchers got 36 volunteers to listen to music and played inaudible tones through hidden subwoofers. None of the subjects realized when the infrasound was active, yet when it was switched on, they reported feeling more irritable, rated the music as sadder, and showed elevated cortisol in their saliva. As it happens, old buildings, particularly if they are echoey, are prime generators of infrasound. It can emanate from aging boilers, ventilation ducts, and the basement pipework found in many old homes. Remember, they're metal pipes. So they vibrate and they produce a sub-acoustic noise that we still sense. So it might just feel like a stuffy, messy room if you're a skeptic, but if you're primed to believe in the supernatural or you're there as a ghost hunter, it definitely could feel like there's something more sinister. So why old houses really do feel spooky. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.